You're listening to the podcast of Village Church in Burbank, California. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org. We hope you enjoy today's message.
So we're right smack in the middle of a series called The Gospel and Tom Petty. What we've done, if you're kind of new, let me just explain what we're doing. This is a change-up. We don't normally do this. I've never done anything like this. But what we're doing is I've chosen six Tom Petty songs for this six-week series, one song per week, from his vast catalog. And we show the song right at the beginning, and then I come back and I preach a normal sermon out of the Bible, but we connect it to the theme and perhaps even some of the lyrics from the song for that week. Now, here's the track that I've chosen for this weekend. I know some of you who may be Tom Petty fans, after tonight, you're going to be wondering, like, when is he going to get to, like, the stuff everybody knows? I promise you that will start, Tina Aust, next week. And the rest of the series, each week, will be, I think, a well-known Tom Petty song. But the track that I've chosen for this weekend, it comes from the same album as the one from last week. It's the 13th and final studio album put out by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers called Hypnotic Eye in 2014. And it's the fifth and final single from that album. It's a song called Fault Lines. We're going to look at it in just a moment. But I want to say a little bit about this song, Fault Lines, because I want you to be... I want you to have the pump primed before you see this song. At the very beginning, Tom Petty writes these lines. He says, "See those fault lines lay down like landmines. It's hard to relax. A promise broken, the ground breaks open, love falls through the cracks." And what I believe Tom Petty's writing about here are the fault lines that divide and fracture human society. I mean, they're all over the place, these ruptures within the fabric of human relationships, society itself. And sometimes it's hard to relax, isn't it? You can't hardly have a conversation about anything without some tremors, and love starts to fall through the cracks. And yet, in the course of the song, he writes, "But I've got a few of my own fault lines running under my life." It makes me think of a guy, maybe you've heard this name before, it makes me think of a guy named Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, just briefly, he was a soldier in the Soviet Army during World War II. And the Soviets, just like every side in every war, they saw themselves, we're the good guys, we're fighting for good. But Solzhenitsyn, during the war, he witnessed some absolutely horrific, unspeakable atrocities committed by his fellow soldiers on his side against German civilians. And it deeply impacted him. A few years later, he was arrested by the Soviets because he had written a letter that was critical of Joseph Stalin, and the Soviets intercepted it. So he was thrown into a Soviet gulag for 8 years. But it was in that gulag that Solzhenitsyn ended up becoming a Christian. And then years later, after Stalin's death, he wrote a book looking back on his life and in his experiences, and he wrote this famous line. I'm just going to paraphrase it, but he basically says this. He says, "You know, looking back on my life, one of the things that I've learned is that the line that separates good from evil, that line does not run between nations. It doesn't run between classes or between political parties." He says, "That line runs within every human heart." Or as Tom Petty writes, "I got a few of my own fault lines running under my life." So watch this song. I'll come back to preach after. All right. Y'all kind of stirred up now, kind of woken up. James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. Pastor James writes this: "You must understand this, my beloved brothers and sisters. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. For human anger does not produce God's righteousness." And then later in that same letter, chapter 3, verse 17, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." So James writes, for human anger does not produce God's righteousness, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Now, right away, I got to address an issue, and it's this word righteousness. It's a good word. Nothing wrong with the word righteousness. The problem, I think, is how we hear it sometimes and how we understand it. Righteousness in the New Testament comes from the Greek word diakosune. Diakosune. Everybody say that. Diakosune. So if you want to write the word righteousness in the Greek, you write diakosune. But diakosune is also the Greek word for justice. Because in the Greek of the New Testament, righteousness and justice mean the same thing. They're the same concept. Therefore, they're combined in one single word, which is actually the case in maybe most languages. But English is kind of like an anomaly because we pull these two words apart and we turn them into two separate words and two separate concepts. So when I say righteousness, what we think of perhaps is a person who is very religiously pious and they live a very moral life and they have a very close walk with God. We think, okay, that's righteousness. That's a righteous person. But when I say the word justice, we tend to think of something much broader that involves an entire community, maybe an entire society of people. This is a just society. But from a New Testament framework, all of this is the same thing. If you see the word righteousness in the New Testament, think of it this way: things being made right, things being exactly the way God would have it to be. See, that includes both me personally and my relationship with God, but it also includes my relationship with you and our relationship with ourselves as a community. So that's kind of the New Testament vision of what righteousness is. One of the things that helps me when I read the New Testament is whenever I see the word righteousness, occasionally I will substitute the word justice, which is perfectly legitimate to do, and it will help me to perhaps better see what's being said. So, for example, in the fourth beatitude, Matthew chapter 5, verse 6, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, diakosune, for they shall be satisfied." Now, if I say it the normal way, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied." Here's how a lot of people hear that. What they hear is, "Blessed are those who want to be really, really spiritual, for they will be really, really spiritual." But that's not what this beatitude's talking about. What Jesus is saying is, blessed are those who see the brokenness, they see the fault lines that fracture human society in their own lives, in their own families, in their own communities. Blessed are those who have this ache when they see and observe the brokenness of the world and they long for God to come and heal it and make it right. Blessed are those people, Jesus says, because they're going to be satisfied with this kingdom that I'm bringing. That's what it means. Another example is this famous verse in Matthew 6, verse 33. "Seek first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things shall be added unto you." Jesus is saying, blessed are those who say, you know what? What I am most interested in is being part of what God is doing in the world. God is coming to make this right. God is in the process of saving and healing and restoring through his son Jesus. I want to see this broken world restored and made new again, and I'm going to invest my life into that. I'm going to make that my priority. Jesus says, blessed are those people because God's going to make sure they have all that they need. All right? So that's what the word righteousness is, and I want you to have that in your mind as we're looking at what James says. When James says, for human anger does not produce God's righteousness, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace, we can summarize James's point this way. Human anger is not the means by which God sets things right. If you want to be part of God's project of making things right, if you have a perpetually enraged soul, you don't have an entrance point into what God is doing. I don't know about you, I grew up listening to sermons as a little kid, as a teenager, that were really kind of entrenched in this us versus them mentality. It's us Christians against those whoever, fill in the blank. And so a lot of sermons that I heard growing up kind of had this thrust of, we Christians, we need to get all fired up. Sometimes I think we need to hear more sermons about, we need to get all chilled out. Because human anger does not achieve God's vision for setting the world right. And a harvest of righteousness, a harvest of justice, in other words, a harvest of things being set right is sown in a certain way. It's sown in peace by those who make peace. Now, a peaceful soul, a healthy soul, is a contemplative soul. And what I mean by that is that a healthy soul is able to see things from many and different perspectives, to see things as they really are. A perpetually enraged and offended soul cannot do this. The angry soul just sees things one way. It's like looking at someone or looking at people through the sights of a gun. You know, you can see them, but you're only seeing a two-dimensional version of them. You're seeing them as you want to see them. But if you could just put that gun down, so to speak, and begin to walk around, you begin to see that person or those people or that issue from a completely different perspective. You begin to see how they were raised. You see how they were brought up. You see their context that shaped them and molded them, the experiences of their life that deeply impacted them. You see their wounds, their hurts, their pains that have been inflicted. You see their fears and insecurities. You see them much differently, which creates the opportunity for you to now respond in a compassionate, truthful, merciful, Christ-like way. That's what wisdom is. Wisdom is by nature contemplative. It's able to take in the whole and willing to see a 360-degree perspective of that person or those people. Hate and anger cannot do this. Let me show it to you in James 3, verse 13. James says, "Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works." Watch this. "In the meekness of wisdom." Now, in our success-driven culture, where we think that everything about wisdom is how to succeed in life, how to win at the game, how to get ahead, how to climb to the top of the ladder, it would never occur to us to connect the idea of wisdom with a word like meekness. But that's why we need Pastor James to help us. That's why we need the scriptures to help us. Because there is a meekness to actual wisdom. And then he goes on in verse 14 with this contrast. He says, "But if you have bitter jealousy," verse 14. Okay. "But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts," if you look at people through the lens of dog-eat-dog competition, and that's the way you look at life, and you have that selfish ambition in your heart, James says, well, don't boast and be false to the truth. He says, "This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic." It's the wisdom of Machiavelli. How many of you have ever heard of Machiavelli? Or you've heard of the adjective that bears his name, Machiavellian. Machiavelli was a Renaissance philosopher and political theorist. And he wrote a book, little book called The Prince, that became incredibly influential. and has really shaped history. It would surprise you perhaps how many world leaders throughout history, especially tyrants and dictators and despots and conquerors, have not only read The Prince by Machiavelli, but they would even keep it by their bedside and just lived by it. Now, I personally think that The Prince by Machiavelli is a horrible book, but it's a book of wisdom. And yet it's the wisdom of how to get ahead, how to manipulate, how to exploit the weakness of your enemies, how to control the populace, how to use cleverness and scheming to gain a political advantage. And I'm sure, at least on one level, I'm sure it's brilliant. And I'm sure it's got a certain kind of wisdom to it, but I'm also sure that it's what James says it is. It's earthly, unspiritual, demonic. It's Machiavellian, we would say today. James goes on, verse 16, he says, "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first," watch these adjectives, "first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere." See, I can tell you that Machiavelli, his book, The Prince, didn't have anything about wisdom that is peaceable, open to reason, full of mercy, impartial, sincere. And then James says in verse 18, we read it a moment ago, "A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." In other words, Machiavellian wisdom is the manipulative wisdom of how to win the game, as opposed to the contemplative wisdom that seeks to understand your neighbor and your enemy and seeks to love them even in the midst of sharp disagreement. So I want to give you an illustration to kind of help you see what I'm getting at this evening. Imagine two people, two different people. Over here, imagine you're watching the news and you see footage from a protest that's happening in Iran on the streets of the capital city, Tehran, which I'm sure is probably happening this week. But imagine you're watching footage of this protest in Tehran and you see an enraged Iranian man and he's got a clenched fist and he's holding a sign that says, "Death to America." All right, so imagine that. Get that picture in your mind. You got it? All right. So we got this guy. And then imagine over here in Burbank, California, an enraged American man posting away on Facebook, "Nuke Iran." All right? So you've got this guy saying, "Death to America." You've got this American man saying, "Nuke Iran." Now, what I want you to see about these two men is that they are the same soul under a different flag. Even though they see themselves as polar opposites and they're saying things that are diametrically opposed, they are in fact the same soul under a different flag. If you take this man in Tehran and you move him over here, and instead of being born in Iran, he's born in Burbank. And if you take this guy who's born in Burbank and you move him over here, instead of being born in Burbank, he's born in Tehran, what's going to happen? They're going to be saying the same things, just reversed. Now it's this guy's turn to say "Death to America." Now it's this guy's turn to say "Nuke Iran." They are the same soul under a different flag. Us versus them groupthink anger is responsible for the greatest atrocities in human history. It's what creates the fault lines that rupture, divide, and destroy society, whereby love falls through the cracks, as Tom Petty writes. And that's why Pastor James wants you and I to know, who follow Jesus, that human anger, perpetual rage, and offense is no entry point into God's project of making the world right. We cannot participate in what God's doing with an enraged soul. A harvest of righteousness, a harvest of things being made right, is sown in peace by those who make peace and who have a peaceful soul. Last week in our sermon based on Forgotten Man, we talked about blind Bartimaeus, but we looked at this contrast between Bartimaeus's prayer. We looked at it in the context of prayer. Bartimaeus cries out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And in the passage right before, we looked at the prayer of James and John, right? Remember James and John? They're like, "Jesus, we want you to do whatever we ask." And that's how they enter into it. They have an agenda. So we looked at James and John last week. I want to look at them again one more time. James and John had a nickname, right? The Sons of Thunder. That's right. The Sons of Thunder. Sounds like a wrestling tag team. The Sons of Thunder. But Sons of Thunder is the English translation from the Greek of the New Testament. Jesus and his disciples, though, did not speak Greek in their casual conversation. They spoke Aramaic. And in Aramaic, their nickname was not Sons of Thunder. It was Sons of Rage. That was their nickname. That's actually what Jesus was calling them, Sons of Rage. And there's this incident when, you might remember, they're passing through the region of Samaria. And I don't want to get into the history of it, but Jews and Samaritans, many of you know, Jews and Samaritans despised one another. A lot of ethnic hostility and religious hostility, even though they were neighbors. And they shared, at least in many cases, they shared some common DNA. Although the Samaritans became mixed with different nations and ethnicities. Won't get into the history, even though I already have. But they're passing through Samaria, these hated Samaritans. A lot of Jews didn't even want to step foot in Samaria. But they're passing through, and you remember the story, there's this one particular Samaritan village that rejects Jesus and the apostles and will not allow them to come in. And the Sons of Rage, James and John, approach Jesus and say, "Jesus, why don't we just nuke them? Can we just call down fire from heaven and burn them up?" Because James and John, their entire lives, they've learned to look at Samaritans through the sights of their guns. So they're filled with rage and offense. And Jesus says to these, I'm fascinated by this. James and John have been following this guy for 2 years. They are his apprentices. In fact, Jesus has sent them along with the others to go and heal the sick and drive out demons and raise the dead. And Jesus looks at these two men who have been following him quite literally and also on a spiritual journey, and he says, "You don't even know what spirit you're of." I wonder if there's been times in my life where Jesus might say, "Hey, Pastor Ryan, you don't know what spirit you're of." I think it takes some humility to even hear that from God. He says, "You don't know what spirit you're of. The Son of Man has not come to destroy, but to save." So if we're going to do things the Jesus way, groupthink, anger, us versus them, perpetual hostility, that has to melt away from our hearts. And the place where it melts away is in the furnace of formative prayer, where we sit with Jesus and we dare to imagine what it would be like to be someone else. We sit with Jesus and we prayerfully meditate on questions like, well, what would it be like to be them? This person who's always driving me nuts. This people group in society that's always getting me infuriated. What would it be like to be them? What if I were them? What if the way they came into the world is how I came into the world? What if their past experiences that have shaped them are my past experiences that shaped me? What if I was born in Tehran with devout Muslim parents? How would that affect the way I look at the world? And more importantly, how would I want to be treated? A healthy soul can do this, but we have to be willing to access that part of our being. And it takes some courage. It takes some guts. It's too easy for us to just drift back into the bestial, into the animalistic, the fight or flight instinct. Part of being created, though, in the image of God is that by His grace, we can rise above and we can become contemplative. Now, no doubt, somebody this weekend is going to say, well, what about the anger of Jesus? What about Jesus' anger when He denounced the Pharisees and He drove out the money changers from the temple? Yes, And the sole target of Jesus' anger makes the point. Jesus' anger was only directed towards Pharisaical, self-righteous groupthink and us versus them anger and hostility that treated human beings as objects. In other words, the only people Jesus was unmerciful towards were the unmerciful. So as I've said before, if you're gonna sin, don't pick that one. Now, I'm not recommending sin. I don't think you should sin. That's probably a good thing for a pastor to say. Try not to sin, right? But if you're gonna sin, put that one on the shelf. Because when I read the gospel, it seems to me that when we begin cultivating an unmerciful soul and posture towards another fellow human being, it becomes very, very difficult now for us to access the mercy of God. And that's why the Pharisees had issues with Jesus. That's why there was so much friction there. The Pharisees, and I say the Pharisees, they weren't monolithic. There were all kinds of exceptions to this. They were really godly, humble, compassionate Pharisees. Sometimes we just lump them all together. But in general, collectively, the Pharisees, first of all, just understand they were a religious political party in Israel. To be a Pharisee, it's not a vocation or a job or anything like that. It was to be of a certain kind of framework of thinking, a way of looking at the world. It's a religious political party in first century Jewish society. And the Pharisees were concerned about society because they saw that it seemed like our society's drifting away from God. And they wanted to see revival. They wanted to see righteousness. They wanted to see Messiah come and set it right. All of these are good longings. And I'm confident that they were correct that their society was drifting away. The problem is they had a certain vision of how things would be made right. And their vision was if just those sinners out there, there's us, we're the righteous. If those unrighteous people could just get their act together, then that would trigger God to come and make things right somehow, some way. And so they became, in general, a very angry, unmerciful people. And the targets of the Pharisees' anger were people like Samaritans, tax collectors, adulterers, prostitutes, Sabbath breakers, and just the run-of-the-mill sinner. But it was a self-righteous anger, justifying itself with Bible verses and a pretense of morality. It was an anger without empathy. It was an anger without mercy, an anger without contemplation. They weren't spending time thinking in prayer, what would it be like if I were a Samaritan? And how would that affect the way I look at the world? They didn't do that. It was an anger without contemplation, without empathy, without mercy. It was scapegoat religion. And Jesus never joins the Pharisees in their kind of so-called righteous anger. In fact, he confronts it over and over again. Sometimes by making Samaritans the heroes of his parables. Remember the parable where you got the Jewish man who's beaten and robbed and left half dead on the side of the road in the wilderness? And the priest and the Levite, these paragons of religious performance and leadership, they pass right by the guy, don't pay him any attention because they got to get to temple to go worship. But it's the Samaritan who happens to pass by and gives attention to the man and stops what he's doing and halts his plans and gives care and concern and nurses him back to health and makes sure he's got everything he needs. And at the end of the parable, Jesus tells his audience, go and be like that guy. If you want to be part of what God's doing, do like that guy did. What's he trying to do? He sees that these people have fallen into the cracks between these faults that divide Jews from Samaritans. They've fallen into the cracks, into this pit, and they're stuck looking at Samaritans through the sights of their guns. And so in confrontation, Jesus is trying to pull them out of that pit. Now let me ask you this, and I'm going to close with this. Were the Samaritans right in all of their doctrines? No. And Jesus is very clear about that in his conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well. You remember, he basically tells her, look, you guys are a little bit mixed up. Your theology is kind of wonky on some things. And you got to understand, salvation comes from the Jews. In other words, what God is doing for the sake of the whole world, it's coming through the Jewish people, and ultimately it comes through him. So he addresses that. Were Samaritans right in their theology? No. Were tax collectors right in rejecting their Jewish faith? No. Were prostitutes and adulterers right in rejecting any sense of morality? No. So why don't we just yell at them, right? The woman who's caught in the act of adultery, who gets thrown down before Jesus, the Pharisees throw her down, and they say, Jesus, the law says, the scriptures say, stone such a woman. What do you say? And they're right. So why does Jesus instead look at her and say, neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more, and gives her a fresh start? Why doesn't he just stone her to death or incinerate her, nuke her? Because human anger does not participate in God's desire to set the world right. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Jesus did not come to be a prosecutor of Torah violators. Jesus came to be a doctor of sick souls. And I want to join him in that work. That's what I want to give my life to. So here at Village, let's sow in peace, not in anger. We don't need any more anger. We don't need you to get all fired up. We need you to cool down. We don't need any more anger because God can't use it anyway. Human anger does not achieve the righteousness of God, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. And it begins and it is sustained over and over again by encountering the beauty of Christ upon the cross.
Thank you for listening to today's message. To learn more about Village Church, visit our website at villagechurchburbank.org.